This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/twim.
This week on the show, YouTube's got Hulu's lame duck in its crosshairs. Alex buys up all the iPhone pans. And the Bannon Way producers tell us how they got a deal with big media. All this on This Week in Media, number 165. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back. Happy New Year. Happy 2010. I am your host, Daisy Whitney. I was off last week.
Is this 2010 or is it 2010?
I've been told the hip people say 2010. And I am endeavoring to be hipper this year. That's one of my New Year's resolutions. Do you know how hip I am today? My socks match my sweater. Look at that. They are purple and gray striped. See? For all of you listening, watching live. How often does it happen that your socks just perfectly match your sweater? I'm just really proud of myself. I even Twittered it today.
I have the same socks.
We have much more exciting things to talk about, though, than my sartorial choices. Thank you for doing the show last week. You and
my
Tim
pleasure.
And Arthur Greenwald and Shira Lazar.
We had a great time.
We're fantastic. So that's great. We have a lot of... obviously, Alex Lindsay is here, my co-pilot.
Yes.
Speaking of co-pilots, did you see Up in the Air?
Not yet.
It's a good movie. Really good movie. Like, one of the best I've seen recently.
I haven't... The last thing I saw was Avatar, which was a good movie. But that was... But I haven't... you know, two kids under two.
Yeah.
You know how it is. You've been there. It's we'll wait until the rental.
Get it when it comes out. It's really quite good. So we've got Alex here today. Here's what we're going to do for the show, because we've got some special guests that Tim, our other co-host, arranged. I'm going to let him do the intro. So I want you guys to stick around, those of you who are watching it live, and those of you who will be listening later on throughout the week. We're going to do kind of like a 10-minute interview at the start of the show. Our structure is going to be a little bit different this time, because we've got some special guests who have a really hot web show out, and Tim is going to introduce them. And then after that, we're going to say goodbye to those guys. And then Tim, Alex, and I are going to dive into the news. So we'll be talking about the Google phone. We'll be talking about Hulu, talking about YouTube, the iSlate, CES, just kind of, you know, the Time
Tons
Warner News Corp thing, lots of stuff. Tim, how are you? And tell us who you've got for us today.
I am doing well. Thanks, Daisy. Hey, Alex.
Hello.
It's good to be back. Well, we have some special guests today. They come to us via Sony, I guess, but originally they started out as independents. The two executive producers from the new web series and digital movie, I guess, would be what you could call it. So we have Jesse Warren and Mark Gant from Sony. And you guys are the executive producers of the Bannon Way. So, guys, tell me a little bit about the Bannon Way for, you know, our listeners that haven't come across it yet.
Mark and I were really frustrated with our careers, and we decided we wanted to put something together that would spoke to both of us and our styles. And we came up with the Bannon Way. It started off as a feature that I had written called Plan F, and I brought it to Mark, and he was this character, Neil Bannon. And then we completely overhauled it to fit this sort of web market that we saw a lot of potential.
What's the story behind it? Like the...
It's about a womanizing thief who's trying to go straight, but he can't escape the criminal lifestyle.
You gotta love that.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. It's kind of like, you know, Smokin' Aces, Ocean's 11, you know, it's really fast paced, you know, sexy, fun kind of vibe.
So you had this script, you guys got together, you kind of rewrote it for the web, but you didn't shoot the whole thing to begin with. What did you guys do first?
Well, thank God that Mark is a great graphic designer, and he put together this killer website that we honed throughout the months. And we spent, you know, like 6 months writing, these episodes, and we tried to shop it around town, and everyone was paying maybe $5,000 for an episode. So we decided that we had to shoot it ourselves.
And everybody was kind of saying to us that, you know,
Because the whole point was for me to lead, be the lead actor, Jesse to direct. And everybody was like, yeah, well, you know, you've never done anything before, you know, that we can, you know, as a lead actor. And Jesse, this would be Jesse's first, you know, big directing gig. So, you know, you guys maybe should just like shoot something so we can, you know, like, you know, pitch it around. Because nobody really seemed to, you know, everybody's like the idea. They said it's like really expensive, you know. So we said, well, you know, we should just do it.
So what did you guys shoot? What was the first thing you shot?
We shot the first two episodes as sort of a proof of concept of how it would work, you know, with the cliffhanger and how we would have a principal, because it's the band Way. His grandfather came up with these principles on how to live. And so we would introduce one of these principles that the audience can sort of, you know, latch onto every other episode. So, yeah, so we shot those two episodes and just shot. They were like 5 minutes each. And we made a trailer out of those two episodes. We tried to make it travel as much as possible, so we could have fodder for this trailer. And we just sent it out to everyone we knew.
So you sent out an email to the trailer that you'd posted online.
Exactly.
Our goal was not just to do a trailer, because, you know, we wanted to be able to show, you know, some stories. So that's why we kind of chose those first two episodes. And they each, both episodes had one of the Bannaway principles. So there's one where he transgresses the principle and one where he obeys it. So we thought it'd be nice to have like a little bookending of, you know, actual scenes to go along with a trailer.
And so how did you get Sony involved? So now you're at the point where you've got backing, if I'm understanding correctly, from the
studio. This is the interesting part, where you posted it online, and then what happened right after you posted it?
Jesse Albert, who Mark knew, he was an agent at ICM. Within, I don't know, less than 5 minutes, he had contacted Mark and said, do you want to sell this? And he had a relationship with Sony. And we didn't want, like, what Sony was doing sounded great, and they were offering more money than anybody else than we had ever heard of. But we wanted to meet as many people as we could in town. So, I mean, we went all over the place, and we met with NBC and ABC, and we weren't sure if we really ultimately wanted to be a TV show or a web series. And ultimately, Sony had this, they wanted to do the same thing we did, which was make it a web series and a feature. And it just seemed like a natural fit. So,
and I had, you know, Jesse was one of the first people that we had met with, and we had shown him, we gave him the first six episodes.
Albert.
Jesse Albert. And he was the one who had said, you know, he was one of the few people that said, you know, they're only paying $5,000 an episode. This thing's way too expensive. You're not George Clooney and you're not Soderbergh. And, you know, and we laughed. Very funny. And we said, well, we'll prove him wrong. And so I, you know, basically updated him about every month. Every time I'd see him, or I'd shoot him an email and say, hey, man, this is what we're doing. And at the time he was he had worked at UTA, and then he was working at 19 Entertainment at the time. And then when he started ICM, it was just kind of one of those natural things. It was just, you know, I was persistent. I wasn't going to like let it go. And, you know, it seemed to pay off. So.
So early on, though, you guys also got some product placement involved in your original trailer, didn't you?
Yeah. Mark was like, he cold called JAG trying to get them involved.
Jaguar Automobile Company.
Yeah. And we tried to make the show very marketable and brand friendly so that we could get, you know, cars, and we could do sunglasses and watches and alcohol and you name it.
You guys just like all that stuff, right?
Oh yeah.
yeah.
Especially alcohol. So that's, you know, and it just to show that this is something that can make money. Everyone's trying to figure out how to monetize the web, and we just wanted to show them, here it is. Here's the website. Here's Jaguar, and here's, you know, the, you know, Moose.
So Sony comes to you with a big bag of money and says, here you go. And were they like hands-on? Were they easy to work with, or were they like a big brother? I mean, how was it working with them, and how much compromising did you guys have to do to get this thing out the door?
Well, first of all, the big bag of money wasn't that big, but it was definitely bigger than we you know, doing it ourselves, for sure.
For the web, it was a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely.
For definitely. a feature, which we really shot, it was not that much money, comparatively. And they gave us creative control. I mean, it was a very tough situation. It was very, the constraints that we had with money and time were very prevalent. But you know, we made it work. Everyone was on board. thankfully, everyone loved the script, and the crew and the cast, they were great. Everyone just put their heart and soul into it.
Yeah, I mean, Sony from the beginning was on board, and you know, we had two great development execs, Michael Ross and Michael Stratford, and they really shepherded the whole project. And you know, we came in, we only had the first six episodes written and an outline, and you know, we basically spent about 3 months, you know, rewriting the outline and writing at the time 20 episodes. And you know, part of this, what you know, the situation was that we had budgeted what 25 minute episodes would be, and that was like an approved budget that, you know, when we made the deal. And then what we didn't realize was that because we're doing a deal with Sony, which is a studio, they have now agreements with IATSE for new media, AFTRA, DGA, and WGA. So you know, we kind of got into an interesting situation where we said, okay, great. Well, we got this much money and we wrote these 20 episodes. And they said, yes, but this much money goes to fringes, goes to payroll tax. So you actually only have this much money. So that was an interesting process for us, is that we wrote these scripts and then had to spend another 2 months rewriting, kind of fitting into a budget, you know, which was, you know, one of our biggest challenges. And I think that was our, you know, if had we known from the beginning that it was going to be an IATSE show and it was going to be, you know, AFTRA and well, we knew it was going to be AFTRA or SAG at the time, but you know, if it was going to be DGA or WGA, all those things, all those fringes, you know, ended up costing us, you know, a third of our budget.
Sure. Now, one of the interesting things about your show is that the way that it differs from a lot of other web series. I mean, obviously it looks great. You shot it on the red camera. You know, you're involved with the studio. But the other thing that really jumps out at me as an independent, you know, producer is that it's going to be available as a movie that you can buy on iTunes the day that the first episode comes out. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, iTunes and Amazon. Yeah. Amazon and iTunes both. I think Amazon's on the 8th on Friday. And you'll be able to rent it on both iTunes and Amazon in 45 days from Wednesday. So on like February 22nd.
So it's only going to be available for 45 days?
Well, it's going to come out on DVD eventually.
Yeah, sure. On DVD, I think in April or May.
Okay, so there's a small window that it's going to be available. I wonder if this has anything to do with the Dr. Horrible model. It seems kind of similar.
Probably.
Yeah. I'm not really sure. I know that this is definitely one of what they did with Angel of Death, and you know, that was their first large budget production. This is actually Sony's first in-house larger production that they've done. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, trying to keep an exclusivity and also, you know, be able to, you know, recoup their money on the DVD and the iTunes and, you know, they would have to at some point pull it back off the web.
Hey, guys, I have a question for you. Where exactly will people find it on the web? You said it's going to be on iTunes. It's going to be on Amazon as well. But it's also going to be offered as a web series. Is that correct?
Yeah. If you go to Crackle.com.
It'll be on Crackle.
You know, we have our own page. And then you're right. Yeah, I mean, we'll have on January 6th, there'll be the first four episodes. You'll have the trailer up there. And every day, a new episode will come out until the 22nd, every work day. But on day one, on January 6th, you can buy it on iTunes immediately.
And how long is it in total? If I buy it on iTunes, what will the length be?
90 minutes.
Excellent. Now, final question for you, and then we're going to wrap up. What happens next? I mean, this is obviously going to be a big deal for you guys throughout the month of January as it releases. Have you talked yet about your future plans and kind of how you leverage off of this, or does it all depend on what sort of numbers the show puts up?
Yeah, it all depends on, you know, there's been talk about things, but it's going to depend on how, you know, it's received.
I mean, for the Bannon Way, I mean, I think that, you know, he and I have projects together that we were ready to pitch. He's got projects for himself. I've got some other ones as well. And so I think, you know, ideally for Bannon, we would love it to go to a TV series. And I think, you know, that would be, you know, the feather in Sony's cap as well, that, you know, it you know, take something from the web, build an audience, And then, you know, ideally we would do a TV series next season with a web series that would complement it. And you'd be able to kind of tell two simultaneous storylines. Maybe it's a backstory, maybe it's other, you know, other characters and backstory and stuff. So in our mind, you know, for Bannon, the ideal would be, you know, a TV series with, you know, a second season web series at the same time. And then, you know, obviously, you know, for me as an actor, you know, get another job. Maybe.
Why don't we do this? Why don't you tell our listeners where you want them to find you online, and then we'll talk again in January and February, at the end of January, early February, and see how it went. So where can people find you guys?
The easy way is thebannonway.com. That's THEBANNENWAY, thebannonway.com, which will, you know, bring you to the Crackle site, to our page for The Bannon Way.
And if our live viewers go there now, can they get a little sneak peek?
They can get a little sneak peek, yes.
Excellent. Nice.
Come back on January 6th.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Jesse. We really appreciate it. Best of luck.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Appreciate it. Let us have, you know, give us our little spiel here.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
See you guys.
Thanks.
See ya.
All right, very cool, Tim. Thank you for bringing them on. It's interesting. It's always good to hear from folks, you know, on the ground who are doing this every day, and especially the part about how, okay, now you got to go change a script again to meet the budget. I mean, that's the reality of filmmaking in any medium.
Well, I think it's really cool with these two guys. I mean, they had not done this before. They had not acted or directed before, and they pulled it out, and they convinced the studio to back them. And for me, that's really exciting to see that's taking place in this space.
Absolutely. That sort of stuff is still happening. We're going to talk a lot about big media and things that are going on with big media and what it means for independent content creators. But before we do that, we have a message from our sponsors, Alex.
Our lovely sponsors. Of course, we'd like to. This Week in Media is brought to you this week by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Now, you can get your free audiobook of your choice at audiblepodcast.com/twim, T-W-I-M. In addition to, of course, you know, getting your free book, it makes us look cool.
Us look cool.
Yeah, we like that. So, of course, you've got over 50,000 titles to choose from, and you can play them back anywhere. So you don't have to stream them. You don't have to just go to your computer. You don't have to do any of that stuff. You can just download them, put them on your iPod, put them on wherever you need to put them, and listen. And so, anyway, now, you are listening to a book.
I know. Daisy's shocking. It's shocking, Daisy's, isn't it? Actually, I've listened to all of the Harry Potter books on audio. But my son and I just finished reading The Lightning Thief, which is the first book in the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series. Yes. A lot of fun. And I'm hearing from a lot of folks as well who have kind of grade school boys. I mean, it's great for boys and girls, but it's another one of those series that really speaks to boys and sort of the adventure quest and everything. So we read it, and, you know, we loved it so much that we got it, and we're listening to it as well. As we take awesome. Turns, sometimes we listen to it together. Sometimes, you know, I find my son wandering around the house with his iPod and brushing his teeth and listening to The Lightning Thief, which is available from Audible.
And so, and so Lightning Thief, and it is, you know, of course, if you like that one, go up and download it. It's free if you haven't done this before. And if not, you know, if there's something else, go up there, get something, get your free
Lots
book.
Of choices.
It's audiblepodcast.com/TWIM. What do we have in the news?
We have a lot of interesting things going on, as you can imagine. I'm going to Will Richmond, who runs videonews.com, N-U-Z-E, which is a place that we source a lot of our stories from, did a terrific recap today of kind of some of the most important stories that took place basically during the holiday break. It's kind of amazing how much news there actually was. So if you're kind of just getting back on the grid, really one of the most important news events that took place right before New Year's was this Fox News Corp and Time Warner retransmission fight.
Wow.
And these things tend to happen around New Year's because that's when a lot of the contracts come due for retransmission. And retransmission is basically the right to retransmit broadcast signals. But of course, these deals become so complex and onerous because most of the media companies have cable interests. And cable is really driving the day. It's really driving the bargain these days. But broadcast isn't.
Right. And one of the issues is that the broadcast model traditionally has been very different than the cable model. So HBO, for instance, they don't have any commercials. How do they make money? The reason they make money is they get, I don't know what the number is, but the last number I heard was like $8 a sub, what they call $8 a sub, which means $8 per subscriber goes directly to HBO. So, and it may be more now, maybe $12, maybe $15, I don't, $6, I don't know what it is. But the point is the reason HBO does that is they get money from every subscriber. I think, but on the other end of that, I think Tech TV got when it was around. I mean, when it was really.
Do they have to pay for cable?
A quarter.
No, but when Fox News was first starting, for instance, you know, in the mid 90s, it was paying for carriage. A lot of networks, when they first start, actually will pay cable operators to be carriage.
Because they have to prove.
Because they have to prove themselves.
And it used to be, it was very different back when I was in, when I worked at Prime Sports Network. So I did promotions for Prime Sports, I was a promotions assistant. And the person sitting right next to me, her entire job was to call cable networks and persuade them to put Prime Sports Network on their cable. Because this was back when it was analog, and there was a constrained supply of channels. Now there's not really a constrained supply of channels. With digital cable, you can really put as many on as you want. So, and there are some that are free to carry. So a lot of times when you see all those international ones, the Indian channel, they that's almost like something that they want to make available to their
sweetens
diaspora.
The pot. It makes it attractive to
advertisers,
you know,
and so on and so forth. And so some of them have a different business model where they want to have, free to carry, stuff that they have out there.
Like an ESPN. The cable operators are paying ESPN a sub fee.
Most of these, whether it's CBS or Discovery, they're all getting probably anywhere from a dime to $10 per subscriber. And that's when you pay your subscription fee to Comcast or to, that's where a lot of the money is going to make all of that work. And so it has been different, but broadcast now, of course, is like everybody else, is feeling the pinch, and they have to come up with the money somewhere.
And so that's what this fight was over, was that News Corp wanted Time Warner to pay to carry its 14 local stations, and that hasn't been the model for broadcasters so far. And that's, of course, because it's the business becoming much, much tougher for broadcasters. It was actually resolved, of course, as these things often are. And I don't know if we truly know the specifics of how it was resolved. I'm sure, somebody out there knows it.
Probably somewhere between 50 cents. So what I think Fox was getting paid was 25 cents a sub. I think that my guess is it was increased to somewhere between 50 cents and a dollar. Fox was asking for a dollar. Time Warner was saying,
What I wonder, Alex, is to me, this is just a little bit of, and what Will points out so well in his article is, he said, I wish Fox and other broadcasters were focused on building new and profitable digital delivery instead of just trying to redistribute cable's revenue. Because in a way, cable networks are doing really well right now. I mean, that's another story we're going to talk about a little bit later. It's just, how the bulk of the ratings that they occupy, as anybody knows watching an awards show in TV these days, that most of the awards are going to the cable shows, that they have a lower cost model and all of that. But basically, what Fox is trying to do is saying business kind of sucks at the broadcast stations. Pay us more so we can make money on them.
Well, now, arguably, they've been getting less money than these cable operators. So the cable operators that are doing well with just the sub, or with largely sub income, HBO and Showtime, that's what they're making money on is their sub rates.
So you're saying they've deserved this all along, that all along broadcast stations should be getting a piece of the pie?
Well, I'm saying that they're all jumping in a little too, I think they're jumping all in a little too, too late. I mean, there's not much cable. I mean, I think the cable is in the danger of becoming just a dumb pipe. That's part of the, trying to figure that equation out. And I think that's one of the dangers. If Fox really wants to undermine or wants to have this argument, start putting your stuff online. Streaming Fox News online. And that would be another way around it. That could get a little bit more, if you really want to prove the model.
I have a question for Tim. Tim, you're kind of our go-to guy on net neutrality. And one of our listeners was, as I was planning the show, Craig Kinnan, I hope I'm pronouncing it, it's either Craig Kinnan or Craig Keenan, says, can we talk about Fox versus Time Warner and what it might mean for net neutrality? It's the same kind of issue, content creator versus content carrier. Could it dampen the net? As our reigning net neutrality expert, does this have any implications at all for net neutrality?
Well, I think it would have had more implications had they not settled, and seen where that went. But I'm sure that there was definitely some leverage that Fox had, having the number one TV show with American Idol, and then also carrying NFL games that's some big leverage to use against a cable provider. But in terms of net neutrality for the independents, I don't see that we necessarily have any leverage. The good thing that we do have on our side is that Google is really, you know, for net neutrality. The danger that's out there right now, though, I think coming up in February, there's a vote on net neutrality in Congress. And what we have to be careful of is that bills get named different things, like the Internet Freedom Act, so that you might think that that bill is good for independent producers, when in fact it's just its name sounds good.
Beware the Internet Freedom Act, says Tim. What would be a better name for it?
I don't know. I don't have a good one right now, but we've got like a month and a couple of days to figure it out.
It's a digital chain gang.
Oh, yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah, but cable operators are worried about the dumb pipe issue that Alex brings up. And, you know, from their standpoint, you know, it's not fair to them. They built all this infrastructure, and for the government to make them allow other people to provide their services over their pipe for free doesn't seem fair either. But that's a whole other side of the coin.
You know, let's talk about cable for a little bit right now. I mean, we have been already, but a really interesting thing that was also pointed out was, you know, a story from Multichannel News said that in 2009, ad-supported cable networks as a group captured 60.7, that's almost 61% of the primetime audience, compared to 32% for the four broadcast networks. That's a major change from 2000, when the broadcasters had about a 47% share compared to cable's 41% share. Cable has basically increased its share of ratings every single year over the last decade. You know, NBC's USA Network in particular has really been a standout. You know, 3.2 million average primetime viewers, up 14% over last year. Obviously, that network has a lot of real juggernaut shows, you know, Burn Notice, like we've talked about before. And the issue with this is, I think everyone knows that, you know, I am a cord cutter. And I wouldn't say I'm an advocate of it for everybody, but I'm an advocate and there to help anybody who wants to cut the cord if you're not a major sports fan, is that I am happy to walk people through it and tell them about my experience. I've been doing it for over a year. It works great for me. It works great for my family. So, you know, again, we're not major live sports fans. That's why it works really well for us. Nevertheless, this whole issue of cable programming being so popular might actually be that kind of stick against, you know, against more cord cutting, because if a lot of networks have really played it safe and kept a lot of their programming close to the vest and only available online on places like iTunes. You know, I mean, we've talked about this before, that, you know, that there are a lot of cable networks. Discovery hasn't put a lot of its shows on Hulu. Interestingly, though, you know, a show like Burn Notice, which is, you know, the most popular show on cable, is on Hulu. But certainly a lot of cable networks have been holding back their top shows for that reason, not wanting to bite the hand that feeds them, i.e. the cable operator. And I wonder, as cable, you know, just continues to be more powerful as a programming medium and as an audience aggregator, does that thwart at all this cord-cutting trend, if there even is one, and does it make things like TV Everywhere more valuable?
Well, I know for me that the issue is that I am moving very much towards recutting my cord. You know, so my cord was cut for 10 years.
You brought it back.
My wife brought it back. She sewed it in. And every once in a while, I find myself sitting in the house watching stupid shows.
Yeah, don't you watch a lot of cable shows?
But I don't watch stuff that I couldn't watch online. That's what I'm noticing, is that what I watch. Now, I watch it because it's a big screen. Now, what I'm getting is I'm finally getting a 27-inch iMac for my house. I have a Mac Mini that's going to be kind of the media server. I'm hooking up a Drobo. I'm going to be doing a Mac break about this whole process, but I'm basically building this all up so that I have all these, you know, all the movies, you know, are all cached, you know, all the stuff is all bought.
That's the big issue. So you're doing all this stuff and you know how to hook up all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And mainstream America doesn't know how to do that. Now,
most people can't even plug their computer into their TV.
Once the computer is hooked up to the TV and you just plug and play, then I think the cord cutting is you know, more of a real danger. And we're going to see some of those TVs at CES this year. My buddy Ted has convinced me to go to CES, so I'll see you guys there.
Excellent.
What you're saying, Tim, is that it's still just too hard for the average person to do. But you know, we're still early days.
it's early days, but the danger is there. And you know, it's interesting. You go back and you look at TV shows, and you look at the high quality of television shows the networks used to have when cable first started. Cable had really crappy shows. The programming was just horrible when they first started. It took 25 years to get to The Sopranos. And I think that as we've seen cable develop into this quality programming, we've seen network television erode into cable-friendly programming, so to speak.
Well, because they have less money now.
Yeah. The cable companies have lots of money, but the networks are trying to produce low-cost programming. And I think that's what's really hurt them, and that's why there's been such a huge shift to the cable companies.
Speaking of what the cable companies are up to, let's talk about Hulu a little bit. This is going to be a really interesting year for Hulu. So in a way, I want to kind of look back briefly at Hulu, but then also look ahead. Now Hulu CEO Jason Kilar did a blog post where he talked about some of the company's progress in 2009. And just here's some interesting figures to kind of have off the top of your head. 95% growth in 2009 in monthly users to 43 million. That's how Hulu ended the year. A 4x growth in monthly streams to 924 million. That's both as measured by ComScore, doubling of available content to 14,000 hours now. The number of advertisers increased from 166 to 408. Of course, Hulu's never really been one to talk about a lot of details of its business model, so there wasn't much that was disclosed about how the different types of ads are doing and how this lighter ad load model is working. You know, is there improved awareness of advertisers, more click-throughs, and so on? But I think really the bigger question for Hulu, actually, there are a couple questions for Hulu this year, is, you know, there was a big jump in traffic from about 25 million to 42 million users, but it actually dipped below 40 million back in October, and it's kind of been steady right around that. So the question is, one, you know, where will additional traffic growth, if any, come from with Hulu? But more importantly, does Hulu become a lame duck in 2010? Oops, I said it 2010. I meant to say 2010. Does it become a lame duck in 2010? Because there is now the big question of, you know, with Comcast buying NBC, assuming that goes through,
well, but I think also
a bit of an orphan.
Well, I mean, I think the other gorilla is YouTube. I mean, I think YouTube is really pushing towards subscription style services.
What it does. Yes.
They've really figured a lot of that out. They have more viewers than Hulu. And if they can figure out how to focus that, I think that becomes a really compelling issue.
So what do you think? What would your predictions be for Hulu for the year ahead? How will it fare, Alex?
You know, I don't watch Hulu anymore.
Because?
I don't really think about it. I found it just more difficult. I think, you know, part of it was that I got onto Hulu and dealing with the ads. I think that, you know, that when they stopped, my whole thing is that it's just easier for me to, with TV, it's easier for me to just either fast forward because I've DVR'd it or to go do something else or figure something else out while it's going on. And the Hulu one was felt like a little bit more work when I was watching it. Also, I don't, because I'm kind of in this transition phase, I don't watch as much on my laptop. I watch it on a big screen, and Hulu doesn't really, you know, it's just hard to get it to play on my 46-inch, you know, LCD screen, you know, and so I kind of lost interest.
Tim, what are your thoughts? How do you think Hulu will do this year?
I think they've got to reinvent themselves moving forward, especially with Netflix and the Roku. I've been watching The Night Stalker, Darren McGavin on the Roku lately, and it's just great to have that Netflix account and just be able to watch all these great movies and old TV shows. I'm finding myself not going to Hulu like I used to. And disconnecting themselves from Boxy, I think, was, you know, maybe something that in the long term could hurt them unless they figure out another way of getting on the big screen. But, you know, the other hand, they don't want to erode their TV business.
It's interesting. I think the biggest issue with Hulu this year really is going to be who watches over it. You know, who cares, frankly, from a media ownership standpoint about it? I mean, I don't think there's any question when Comcast, you know, if that goes through, buys NBC, where it's going to be placing its bet. That bet is going to be on TV everywhere. It's going to be on Xfinity.
Whatever
resources there are with Hulu, I think will get poured into that. And I don't know that we're going to see any significant growth or movement with it this year.
Which has a stronger brand, Hulu or TV everywhere?
Well, Hulu does, but I think that, you know, what is the stronger business case that the powers that be believe in.
Well, and I think
and
also,
I think the powers that be at Comcast believe very strongly in taking what works about Hulu and making it fit into a new model. I mean, Hulu could become the brand for Xfinity.
Right. Well, and I think also the other thing that we're not talking about yet is that Hulu is a flash site, and Apple has a new thing that's coming out sometime soon.
Really?
That we think that it might. Evidently, there's something that is kind of
we're not allowed to talk about that thing.
We are now. The moratorium is over. All right,
the gloves are off.
Right, the gloves are. Let's talk about the ice blade.
Because
when
of
is
the
it going to be announced
on the 26th of January?
Is the 26th?
The rumor is the 26th is the announcement date.
What is this? There was an interesting article, I think, in Business Insider. I've got to track that down in my story list about, you know, speculation a couple years ago over what the first iPhone would look like. And I think that, you know, people are wondering with all of this speculation. Oh, here it is. Remember the very first iPhone, the one that sold for $249, had an iconic click wheel, a cool slide-out keypad, and a unique two-battery design, which ran on Apple's very own nationwide wireless network. No, of course you don't remember that, because that was actually the speculation about it. It wasn't actually what was unveiled in January 2007. So I guess the question is, with all of this speculation about the iSlate, what is it? Is it going to look at all like what we are going to talk about that we think it looks like?
I think, or does it matter? The pressure is for us to somehow guess.
Right. So okay, guess. Guess, Mac, God, Alex.
My guess is it's going to look a lot like an iPhone, except twice as big.
Yeah, mine too. In fact, if you go to my blog, onetimstreet.com, there's a video there that the folks at Time did for Sports Illustrated magazine and how you could enjoy Sports Illustrated on a tablet. And I swear it looks like an Apple product.
Well, and the I guess I would say is that I don't know if Apple, you know, we think that Apple's going to release one. I think this is the year of the tablet, whether Apple does it or not. I think that that's going to, you know, we're going to see tablets. I think we're going to see the one laptop is putting out is working on a tablet. Google is evidently working on a tablet. Everybody's working on a tablet. You know, I think that in some ways the Kindle proved that the tablet idea was a good idea. I think that the issue with the Kindle that it's going to have a hard time with is that the Kindle's a unitasker. It's something that is only does books and magazines and everything else. I think the next generation of these tablets. The problem is people didn't want a whole computer, so they didn't want just a computer that was a touchscreen. You know, they really want they want something that's in between.
If the price point is high, as has been speculated, if we're talking about something $500 to $1,000.
$800. That's my, okay. $799. That's my
not an insignificant amount of money, and you could get a netbook for that. What is the difference? Just that a netbook has, you know, two sides and you open and close it, whereas a tablet would be one flat screen.
It was just a phone. It was just the iPhone was just a phone. I mean, it was just like it was just another phone. Why would you spend I spent $599 on a phone.
Is that really what the first iPhone?
The first iPhone was
that's what everybody spent.
Phone. Everybody spent.
Everybody
all
who ran
on those
Elgato spent five. Wow.
Phone. That's it was just nuts. A stupid phone. And so the thing is that's what everyone looked at, but it changed everything. And I think that the level of impact, and the reason that I'm excited about it, I have to admit, is I've talked about this on other shows, possibly on this show, is that I went through the process of trying to design one of these. So we really felt like there was a huge market, you know, for this thing. And the idea is this media device, the iPhone is just a little too small to like just set somewhere and watch it while you're working,
yeah,
or watch it while you're cooking, or watch it while you're trying to, you know, and to me, this device is that beyond your immediate reach device where I can set it down on the table while I'm having breakfast or whatever and not be squinting at it. That's the problem with the iPhone. If I want to set it down and be watching some video or something like that while I'm eating breakfast, it's a little too far away.
Would you use this as your phone too, or do you see this as being kind of a standalone multimedia reading
device
where you still have your phone for actual calls? Not that you make calls.
It's sort of like, hi, how's it going? Well, a couple of things. One is that I almost never, ever put my iPhone up to my ear anyway, unless I'm surprised by a call. And usually if I'm surprised by a call, I don't answer it. You know, so, usually I have a headset, you know, hooked up. And so I think that it could work that way. I think that, I think that it could do that. I'm not that interested in it doing that.
It depends on if it'll fit in your pocket or not. You know, if it's too big for your pocket, I don't think it's going to be that popular as a phone.
Well, yeah. And now the one thing I will say is that I bought these This is how bad it is. This is how bad my addiction to my iPhone is. So I get the new Eddie Bauer catalog, and I open up to the guy's pants, and I see these cargo pants, and I look at one of the pockets on the cargo pants. It's in the catalog, and I go, that pocket looks exactly the right size for an iPhone. And so here's the worst part. Then I go over to Eddie Bauer, which is only a block away from my office. I walk over to Eddie Bauer, and I go in and I try the pants on, and I put my and I was like, you know, I was kind of putting them on myself, but what I was really trying on was whether the iPhone was going to fit into that little pocket when it was on my leg. You know, like, is it really going to fit?
That is your best story ever.
Then here's the thing: is it and then it fits, and I don't mean it fits well. It is, that pocket had to have been designed for an iPhone.
Yeah. They're in cahoots.
Everything is just so you could slide the iPhone. You could pop it right in there and zip it closed. So then, did I Twitter it? No, I did not Twitter it, because I still went to two other Eddie Bauer stores, because I've gotten a little thinner and I'm on the thin end of Eddie Bauer now. And I went and bought all the ones that fit my, there's all three of them before I did this story.
I got my pants.
You know, I got, so the thing is, I was like, I quietly,
Alex is looking out for number one.
I was like, people will go buy that. What I knew is that, as I said, I'm on the low end now. Eddie Bauer, like, I'm on the smallest pants they make. But the problem is, I know that there's not that many down there, and I knew that one or two people seeing it would be enough to have it go away, and this is the end of the run, you know. And so I went and got mine first, and now I'm telling you all. Now the reason,
now all you sad sacks will be iPhone pantsless.
No, as long as you have, there's plenty of 34 and above. It's just the 30 32s are hard to find. So anyway, the reason
what about
I said
the eye slate,
that,
so, though? Where is that going to fit?
This is why I said the reason that I told that silly story was because I think that you will see people making, either overtly or non-overtly, you know, making the cargo pant pocket just big enough to put that eye slate in.
You could start. You could carry a Merce soon if you'd.
Yeah, like. I mean,
you don't
it
need
totally
a Merce, though.
It makes sense.
You can put it in.
You go to Brookstone. You walk in Brookstone. Everything's made for the iPhone there. Yeah. It's crazy. It's like, so this will just be the next.
It would be coat pockets that are just big enough for one of these things. Not probably shirt pockets, because that would be crazy geeky. But coat pockets, cargo pants. It's going to be a whole revolution in cargo pants, I think. You know, and it's so anyway. I think that I think people will make stuff that makes it sense, you know, for this product. Now, I think the 10-inch one that people were talking about, I think it's way too big. I don't think that's going
to
actually.
If you had to guess at the form factor, what would it be?
Big iPhone.
Okay. What about, let's talk about the Nexus One, because that's going to come out sooner. That's coming out. When is that coming out? Tomorrow? Tuesday, January 6th. No, sorry, I apologize. January 15th is the 4th.
Right.
So the Nexus One is supposed to be introduced. It's going to be powered by Android 2.1 operating system. It's going to be unlocked, we're told, which means it can work basically on multiple providers using a GSM network. You know, there's been a lot of chatter about this. I know you're an iPhone fanboy. Am I understanding that correctly, Alex? But step aside from
fanboy.
That a little bit.
Fanboy. You know, I just want to say for the record that my primary music device is a Zune. Just kind of throw a little curve in there for you.
Got really quiet.
A couple months ago, I got a Zune, and it's a subscription service that I've always been talking about. I wanted to test it, so I got it, and I love it. And now I just go up to I'm on the Zune Marketplace all the time going, I'll just download all of those albums because I'm kind of interested in them. I don't have to pay for them. I mean, I'm paying a subscription. Right. It's like BitTorrent without the guilt.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I like
it. Yeah, and the screen is absolutely gorgeous on the Zune.
You know, I didn't like it at first. It took me a little while to figure out how to use it. And now that I use it, I love it.
Well, the interface is, the picture quality is unbelievable.
Absolutely. So.
Tim, what do you think about the Nexus One phone?
Well, what I'm waiting to happen with Google, I mean, this seems to kind of play into what I'm speculating may happen someday, and who knows, I could be totally crazy about this, but could you imagine Google blanketing the country in WiMAX and just having a device that everyone could use with free connection everywhere, and it would be like all the ads you could eat?
You think that's where they're going?
I don't know. I mean, at some point in time, I think the pendulum's going to swing back, and services that we now pay subscription for are going to be open up for free with advertising. And who seems better at doing advertising than Google?
No, I think that's got to be part of the. There was a great. I think this was in our notes. The great thing about I think Tim actually put it up about how Google approaches the market. You either dominate or commoditize.
Yeah, or the Google does things where it still makes 96% of its revenue from text ads, but a lot of the choices that Google makes are strategic.
Yeah,
you know that it's to protect its existing market by getting into a new market. It was interesting. I was at Google a couple of weeks ago interviewing some executives about real time search and closed captioning and things like that. And the real time search that we talked about a couple episodes ago, I think when Gary Vaynerchuk was on, one of the things that Google Dylan Casey, the Google product manager I talked to, pointed out, he said it was very important that we made sure that the real time search worked on mobile phones as well. Because that's how important the mobile phone market is to Google, is to make sure that it is not just a reasonable facsimile of the Google experience, but right. That if you're accessing the internet on your mobile phone or doing whatever it is, that it's just the same, that you can right. look things up just the same, that it knows where you are and can truly reflect that. So I think it's clear that mobile is such an important play. I mean, Scavengers is this company that Google just invested in that does location-based mobile games that work on any platform.
Right.
There's a lot of chatter about it. It's interesting though, because it's it's getting it's clear that the device people are most interested in.
The rumor is they're announcing on Wednesday. Is that the plan?
I think so. I don't remember if it's January 5th or January 6th, but we'll have to see. I mean, it's
coming soon. Next week we'll be talking about it.
Next
week is all CES.
Yes, you'll be at CES. Well, actually, three of us have been at CES.
Well,
right?
All of us will be there. Yeah.
I'm only there for one day, so but I'll be doing some interviews.
When are you getting there?
I think I'm driving out with my buddy Ted on Wednesday, late morning, early afternoon. Okay. So probably either Wednesday night.
I'll see you Wednesday.
And I'm just going in for the day on Friday, day in, day out.
I'm going in Tuesday night and leaving Thursday night.
But I'm doing some interesting interviews. I'm talking to somebody from Xbox, talking to somebody from Starz, talking to Digital Smiths, and talking to an interactive TV research person. So I'm doing interviews with those folks on Friday, and then I'm coming back home. One more story that I think is important to get to is what happens to Netflix in the year ahead? That there was an interesting story that in Video News, it kind of wrapped up a Bloomberg Business Week piece that sort of highlighted Netflix is obviously trying to woo studios to get more recent releases with Watch Instantly. As anybody who uses Watch Instantly, probably most of our listeners, know that there's about 17,000 titles right now, but you don't always get the most recent, the newest releases. But that Hollywood is a little bit wary of giving Netflix the most current releases, the most current windows to its movies. And it just, to me, that fear suggests, it just underscores what a powerful place Netflix is in right now.
Well,
I mean, with the DVD business changing, don't you think?
Well, it's changed the way I watched. I mean, I have to admit, the reason that I'm looking at re-disconnecting, of getting off of there, a big piece of that factor is my Roku, or the Netflix Instant Play. And it is... I just find that I loaded that thing up. I've got 270 things in my instant queue, and some of those individual things are like all of the seasons of CSI, and all is not CSI. I don't like CSI. Law and Order.
Yeah, that's your story.
And it's like the stupid, I don't want to think. I just want to watch something for a couple. I just queue up a Law and Order. Someone's going to get killed tonight. And they're going to figure it out, and then we're going to move on. And I find that between that and being able to watch, I have a very obscure.
But you're not. Are you a big new release person? Though? See, I am. Like, I don't
I can
always
wait.
Get you. I know you go to the movies when you absolutely have to see it on the screen,
right.
And I don't always do that. So I want a better selection in the Netflix new releases.
Right.
I want to be able to see. In your view, if I were you, I would say, oh, okay, in 2 months I'll watch Up in the Air on Netflix new releases, but it probably won't be there because it's just, they don't always have, the titles. Like right now, if you look, they're not going to have all the titles that came out in September and October. They might have a handful. I mean, we were looking through it the other day and couldn't really find anything new that was interesting, which could be a reflection on the state of the movie industry, could be a reflection on Netflix's industry. We watched 10 Things I Hate About You. It's a good movie.
Well, and the great thing with the Roku, though, is that for the stuff that you want that's new, You know, I find that a lot of times that's all available on the Amazon Unbox. So the Amazon is right there in the Roku. So I can sit there and go, you know, oh, I can't find anything. I'm willing to pay $4.99 to watch a new release off of Amazon, too. And
maybe
all
I'm
that
just
stuff.
Cheaper than you.
What?
Maybe I'm just cheaper than you. That's why.
Probably. You know, I'm not very good at that. You know, the thing is, I don't live a generally expensive lifestyle. I don't watch that many movies. I don't eat out very often. I don't do a lot of things. And so on the stuff that I just kind of do, I don't really think about the cost.
Right. As well you should. Hey, okay, we're going to talk very, very quickly about YouTube, and then we're going to wrap up so we can stay on time. But as I promised, we're going to touch on a lot of important stories and companies, clearly, for the year ahead. And, you know, Alex brought up already that one of the other issues that Hulu will face this year is just competition from YouTube. And there was a great New York Times article that talked about how a team of YouTube developers is analyzing viewing patterns and tweaking its recommendations to encourage more usage on YouTube. I mean, we keep learning all these interesting things about what's going on behind the scenes about YouTube, you know, possible considerations about subscription offerings, more premium content, you know, things they're doing to really understand, you know, what consumers are responding to with ads. And this one says that time on the site increased by 50% in the last year, and that the average number of clips viewed per user per month jumped to 83 in October, up from 53 a year earlier. Still, YouTube is a snacking medium. It hasn't yet cracked 4 minutes per user. But these are just, you know, interesting data points, and the fact that YouTube is looking at it, it just suggests that there could be a really big opportunity, Alex, for YouTube to become Hulu if Hulu is indeed the lame duck.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that YouTube is in the pole position to do that. I mean, they have the user base, they have the, you know, they have all the pieces in place. It's just a matter of them figuring out how they funnel those people. And the danger for YouTube, of course, is to funnel it in a way that doesn't alienate the current users. That's the hard part, is you've got a bunch of people who are edgy. They want to have a certain, they want it to be informal. There's a lot of people who feel like it's part of their culture and how they interact with each other and how they interact with the world. And so if they feel like it is, you know, they've sold out to the corporation, the question is, how many people will they lose? Maybe not many. But there's a lot of core people that put up a lot of stuff there that that edginess is part of the culture. We've had to shoot some videos for YouTube for some of our clients, and I know that there's always a big discussion of not crossing the culture, you know, making sure that it doesn't look
like a YouTube video.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
it has to
concern.
Look like a YouTube video. It doesn't.
That if it's on YouTube, it must look like
if
that.
It looks too professional, you're not going to get any coverage.
Tim, very quickly, what do you think is going to be the biggest challenge for YouTube in the year ahead and the biggest opportunity?
Well, I definitely think that some type of pay-per-view opportunity is the big one. I think the toughest challenge for them is going to be dealing with the content owners of premium content and getting it there in a way that is going to make them feel comfortable. I mean, for all the mid-tier content, everybody loves YouTube. You know, it's free bandwidth. Have a nice day. You know, the tough struggle for us is still monetizing. And if there was like an Amazon-type play there where we could upload our stuff and charge a pay-per-view price on it, that would be great for all of mid-tier content. But I don't know how well the studios are going to react to that, because it's a love-hate relationship. I mean, they love it for what it can do to promote their movies and get people into the theaters, but they hate it for how it undermines their business model.
Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com.
Excellent. Alex, where do you want people to find you?
I'm on the Twitters.
At Alex Lindsay.
All one word.
So simple. There's only one handle, remember. You can find me at daisywhitney.com. And also, Twitter is a great way to reach me. I often, actually every week, I Twitter when I'm planning This Week in Media. I love suggestions from listeners. Try to get to as many of them as I can. So continue to send me your story ideas. And just a little teaser, we're working on some kind of new formatting for the show that will be able to incorporate listeners in advance and in our planning in terms of what they want to hear from stories. So stay tuned. We haven't worked out all the details yet. We're going to get to that. This mess you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.